Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, August 20th, 2020, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.
Tested, this is only a test. You're tested today.
All right, that was interesting. Well done. That was,
love it.
I click like. That was a intro piece created by Chip McDonald. Thank you so much, Chip, for sending it. That was sent to us way back in June. That's how long we've been doing this, but keep them coming. It's been great. I've been loving hearing different styles of intro themes, some of them longer, some of them shorter, following the rules. You can send them over Twitter, SoundCloud preferred. I can download it, and we guarantee we will play them in a future episode. In fact, we may never have a permanent theme song. Maybe that's our thing. A rotating theme song every week. Something to look forward to. Anyway, I'm Norm. Welcome to the show this week. And as always, I have with me Jeremy Williams.
Hi, Norm.
Hi, Jeremy. I heard you were building some Lego over the weekend.
Dude, the Nintendo set is so good. It is so good. Like, it is my favorite. And you guys were ragging on it because it's just a gray box.
Whoa. Oh, the set, we've been sold on the set.
We know we like the TV, but you were saying the console, just a gray box. Why would you want it? I got to tell you, I challenge you to find me any Lego kit that looks so much like the original thing that it could be mistaken for it. And this thing, I guarantee you, anybody walks in this room is going to think, oh, he has a Nest sitting there on his little entertainment system next to the other Legos.
Is that what you want out of Lego, for it to look so realistic?
Look, what I want from Lego is to appreciate the ingenuity, the engineering of the thing, of the craftsmanship as I build it. And this has that in droves. And I'm only on the console. Like, the thing that it does, it has like a do you know how you put the cartridge in and it goes down? It has a spring-loaded thing that goes down, like the original
the mechanism. Yeah.
It stays down, and then you click it again and make it come up, and that's done mechanically with Lego. It's crazy.
That is cool. I didn't know that. Of course, I haven't started building mine yet. You're giving spoilers now. I'm going to take your word for it. Are there parts that are internal in the NES that, I guess, are hidden after the build? That's one of those things I appreciate of some of the fan builds, where like you build things. It's almost like Gundam. You build the internals, and you as a builder know it's there, but once you've completed it, the facade hides it.
Do you know about this? You're feeding me this.
I don't know.
There is an Easter egg, and it's been published, and I will not spoil it for you.
Okay.
But I will tell you, I forgot about it because I'd read the Easter egg, and I'd forgotten about it, and I was building this thing thinking, what the heck is this? This doesn't look right at all. Like, the colors are wrong. I don't remember this. And then as soon as I saw it, my mind...
All right. Hyping it up. I'll have to build mine sometime in the future.
We've reached the level where now builds have spoilers in them. We have to put spoiler warnings on builds. This is new level.
That's what you're paying for with Lego. 21 bags, you're in one every day?
Yeah.
Okay.
3 weeks.
All right. We'll check in with you 2 weeks later and see how it goes. Kishore, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Hockey's back on?
I watch so much hockey, Norm. It's not healthy how much hockey I've been watching. I'm watching hockey right now.
I know you were probably doing it last week. We didn't have you on. We missed you. We're going to have a moment of science. I know there are lots to talk about, lots to update on. But if you're in the Bay Area, if you're in California, you'll know that the sky is burning right now. So everyone in a hot zone, literally, please stay safe, because these fires are no joke. It's been extremely dry. The lightning has not helped. And as of right now, none of this is contained. So stay indoors. It's another reason to not go outside, because air quality in the area is just not so great. Listen to a podcast, build some Lego, all recommended things to do. And for us, next thing is to talk about our top story.
Top story this week.
I don't have my coffee. That's not the top story. I just realized the ritual I have of playing the interstitial music and then sipping a cup of coffee. I went to grab for it, and I realized I didn't have it. I'm so bummed. It's totally going to screw with me. Oh, okay. our top story. So many things
may suffer.
Yeah, we're gonna keep it short. That's why. So many top stories to choose from. I had to debate in my head whether we're gonna talk about Oculus or Apple Epic. We're gonna talk about Apple Epic because I think that, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the things that impact the most people immediately right now, that's what matters. But it is a little bit of a follow-up from our discussion about Microsoft and Apple last week, the revelations of why xCloud will not work on iOS because of the App Store guidelines. This is not exactly that, but you may have heard that Epic is in a little bit of a fight with Apple. So to present the sides of this, because there are a lot of points to consider, we are going to try a new format where our two co-hosts here, Jeremy and Kishore, you guys are going to present the arguments from each side. Is that right? How's this going to work?
I said I'd be happy to present either side because I'm an open-minded individual, but I did say it'd be fun if I did Epic. I'm happy to do Epic. And Kishore, you said that you'd be willing to represent Apple here.
Yeah, I am no Apple fan, but today only. I'm going full Jobs here. I'm ready to defend my brethren in at the UFO spaceship. Let's do this.
Yeah, I mean, advocacy doesn't always align with your personal beliefs, but
debate club.
The facts out. Let's lay out the facts first. So, what happened last week? I'm sure the big thing you may have heard is Fortnite was taken off not only iOS, but the Google Play Store. And it only been instated in the Google Play Store for 4 months or so. Epic had previously asked users to sideload on the Android devices because they wanted to avoid the 30% in-app purchase cut that Google would take. And that is exactly why they're kind of instigating this. Maybe that's too strong a word. One of their problems with the current infrastructure is this 30% cut on the iOS side. So Fortnite removed from iOS store, and then more recently, just 2 days ago, Apple had announced that they would, as of August 28th, revoke Epic's developer license for iOS. Meaning that Epic would say that Epic has said that that would mean that they will not be able to continue Unreal Engine development on iOS devices, not only for Fortnite, but for any developer licensing Unreal. So, where should we begin?
Welcome to Permaban Country, Jeremy. Population Epic. Let's see what you got.
Small detail, Epic unlocked within the iOS and Android versions of Fortnite the ability to make in-app purchases directly to Epic for a $2 or 20% discount. You get the same V-Bucks for $2 less if you pay directly with Epic versus go through the official stores, which was still an option.
So that kind of that system, that in-app system, is the thing that bypasses Apple's policy of needing to go through their system of payment, of customer service. And what it does is it does affect the new downloads of Fortnite. But I think for people who currently have already installed Fortnite, you could still play Fortnite and you can uninstall and even reinstall it. So let's start with the Epic side of the argument. Jeremy, representing Team Epic, only $3 billion in value, $17 billion in valuation. Is that right? What's the
compared to $2 trillion? You know, who? What does it even matter? Mr. Chan, is that a computer you're sitting in front of? Is that a PC or a Mac?
It's a PC.
It's a PC. Imagine if you sitting at that PC, all of the software that you have on that PC. Imagine if you purchased every piece of software on there, every creative app, every web browser, every text editor, every unzip program, everything you've ever bought online, as well as all of the purchases that you've made within those apps, if you made those from a single store online, I think you would call that absurd. I think you would not want this for yourself or for anyone else because you could call that a monopoly, which of course is illegal, and you wouldn't want that. The government wouldn't want that. People wouldn't want that. And yet that is exactly the situation that we have here on iOS and iPadOS, where every single app is bought through one Store, the App Store. And when it was unveiled 10 years ago, Steve Jobs said, let's give the developers 70% of everything that's sold in the App Store. And that was probably at the time, I think that was a generous thing to do. I mean, they're coming from developers traditionally get far less than that in the retail industry when they have to box something and ship it and put it on shelves. 70% seemed great. And 30%, he said that we'll hold on to in order to run the App Store, you know, not a source of profit. In fact, he said publicly that he didn't expect the App Store to be a source of profit for Apple. Well, times they change, don't they? Don't they, my friend from Apple? Yes, they do. Because now we are 10 years later. And I would say at the time, you know, that 30% for Apple probably went to good use. They had to build the App Store. They didn't have the phone market share they do now. They didn't have the number of users, and so nor the number of apps. And so that 30% probably meant something. But many years later, as just with the laws of manufacturing, if you the more of something that you make, the cheaper each individual thing becomes. The more users you have, the cheaper it is to run that App Store. What was that?
Economies of scale.
Exactly. Now let's just imagine. Apple's never said publicly how much they earn from the App Store. So that it really is what's at stake here. Like, does Apple need that 30%, or are they just stealing it from developers and our common customers that we share? Well, let's take a look at what that profit could be. They've never actually publicly said, but we can deduce it. What would you say if I said over the past 10 years, Apple has earned, let's say, $1 billion in revenue from the App Store? A billion.
That sounds low.
And yet, $1 billion, $1,000 million.
That is $1 billion.
Yes. What could you buy with that? I'll tell you. The average software engineer at Apple, the world's best software engineers, they earn $150,000 a year. $1 billion is enough to hire over 650 software engineers every year for the past 10 years and put them to work on the App Store. Now, that's absurd. Of course, you don't need 650 software engineers to run the App Store. So let's say, just for argument's sake, you only take half that, which is still an absurd number. You have hundreds of millions of dollars left over to pay for infrastructure, pay for your hard drives and your bandwidth costs and your design costs for the App Store. You know what? The more I think about it, that actually seems like a fair amount to have to pay to run the App Store. $1 billion over the past 10 years. And yet, sadly, we know that Apple does earn far more than that, a grotesque amount more than that. In fact, they earn 5 times that every year. Over the past decade, they've earned $51 billion from the App Store, from the App Store revenue, from that 30%. Now, that is a grotesque amount of profit that could otherwise be left with developers to make better products, to be given back to consumers, which is what we want to do, as seen very clearly in our demonstrated in-app purchase direct to Epic, where you save 20%. We think you should save maybe 10% for yourself, which is still, it would be $17 billion. Over the past 10 years, if you kept 10% instead of 30, that would be fair. And I think that clearly you can agree with me, Mr. Chan, that the delegate from Apple here has well taken more than his fair share from this market. And in closing, I just want to say that I think Apple is probably missing the point. They should be fighting for, just please let us hang on to this 10% that I'm suggesting they should be asking for instead of 30. When really, in reality, what we're asking for and what people want from what our customers demand from them and what we think Congress will agree upon is that there needs to be an alternate path to that App Store that cuts Apple out entirely. They should not be the only place where one can buy software or install software. There should be a way to install it, an opt-in process for users to install software themselves as they can on Android, as they can on every PC platform that existed before the iOS. And that is what we think is the right thing to do. And we hope you'll back us up on this. Thank you for your time. Hashtag free Fortnite.
I give your argument 8 out of 10. Last 2 out of 10, disappointing. It was not in rap form. That was my big disappointment there.
I think the audience should,
exactly.
I think it should get a plus one that we didn't see Jeremy rap. Your Honor.
Secretary Hari.
Yeah, Your Honor, I just want to thank my colleague at Epic for just extolling why Apple is such a good company. Apparently, my friend at Epic, whose entire business model is selling fake currency for real currency, has forgotten what the word capitalism means. The point is to deliver better products with better service in exchange for money. And that's what Apple has spent the last 50 years, maybe 40, doing. You knew what the agreement was coming to the App Store. It was 30% across the board. We don't make exceptions for anyone. It's 30% for everybody. And you've opted into this. And in exchange, you get access to millions, maybe even billions of people who have also opted into the App Store because they believe in what we offer. Those millions of users don't come for free. We do a lot of work in developing products that they believe in, secure systems so they know the apps that they install will work and not create additional security issues on their devices. And we create experiences that we know our users will love. Being on the App Store is a privilege. It is not a right. And that is true because there are other options out there. Enjoy your time at Google Play or the Amazon App Store, I tell you, my friend, because they are available to you. So this is not a monopoly in any way, shape, or form. The second thing I might remind my friend at Epic is that what they just experienced was a clear rule that has been applied universally across all of our apps for many years. We have been in conversation with Epic for many months about how if they enable this feature, they will be banned. And Epic's response was to preemptively hire a law firm, an antitrust law firm, and then enable this feature. They were searching for this ban. They were not looking for a solution around this. And let me tell you a little something about this game, so-called game called Fortnite. Fortnite, the rage of 2018. What you might have noticed if you take a deeper look at this game is that their user base has leveled off. You'll notice that some of the top streamers who drive a lot of the adoption of games no longer play Fortnite. Why now is Epic looking for a better deal on the percentage? Is it perhaps that their business is unable to attract new users? And in order to keep revenues up, they're looking for a better arrangement with their vendor. And the vendor, in our case, us, is saying no, because that would be unfair to everyone else in the App Store who is paying us to create a fantastic experience for them. Apple is playing by the rules that we set years ago. Epic is the one saying those rules don't apply just to them. They are no hero in this fight. They are fighting to maintain the profits of a game where you exchange real currency for fake in-store currency so you can have your character do a dance. Like, let's not make Fortnite be something that is changing the experience and lives of users around this world. It is not. It is a silly game. And frankly, Your Honor, I have better things to do than to talk to this pittance of a company about their experience in the App Store, because we have billions of users across this world that depend on the App Store and the products that we make to deliver a great experience, especially in these hard times. I yield my time.
I give this argument. also an 8 out of 10.
What? wait, we have a special appearance by my friend Tim Cook right here. Oh my God. Thanks, oh my Tim. God.
Tiny Tim right there, hiding behind Kishore in your Zoom backdrop. Thank goodness my decision is not subject to congressional approval. I'm going to draft a statement of neutrality.
cop out.
We're not going to answer this question today, but I do think the points you guys make for the relative sides, playing the advocates, cover, I think, a large portion of it, but it merits diving deeper. And this, I think, we can come at it from the perspective of the developer relationship and then also the user and consumer relationship, right? Let's start with the Apple side. We're going to go in reverse order. The argument that from Apple seems to be twofold. One, that this end-to-end system of owning the stack from the hardware to the software, things that at least us in the media and users have touted as their strength, they have acknowledged as one of the reasons for their success, even though that's not a guarantee, right? People who own their systems end to end, if that's not a good experience, it can be a big disadvantage to them. They've made it an advantage to them. Made it one of the reasons that they can operate at this scale, they can engineer to this level and have a quality of experience that is up to Apple standards, whatever you may think of those standards and that experience. It's designed, it's intentional. And part of that now bleeds into not only the App Store, but also the payment systems, not only with Apple Pay, but also in-app purchases. And then when we talk about 10 years ago and Steve Jobs making an announcement about the App Store, remember, App Store wasn't a launch with iOS. That came later. Web apps, the iOS, iPhone OS, and the iPhone opened with a relatively open system of quote-unquote applications. You could design a website that could provide, you know, as long as it worked with their mobile Safari, provide that type of, you know, in phone experience. When they did the App Store, that 30% cut was, I think, like you said, Jeremy, in their minds, not a money making operation. It was to offset not only development costs, but also the credit card processing fees. 99 cent apps. This is all analogous to the iTunes model they'd already established and was a little bit of a money maker for them. That, of course, 10 years later is a whole different world. And in-app purchases is, I think, what we're talking right now. And it'd be remiss not to talk about Amazon as the other kind of, you know, player in this and the fight between Amazon and Apple with in-app purchases. To this day, you still cannot in Audible, you know, make an ebook purchase in, you have to, and Amazon has ceded that 30% in things like Prime Video. And, you know, if you make a rental, they will pay that. But, and even in Amazon, one of the big titans in the tech industry and orders of magnitude bigger than in Epic Games have played by these rules. And so you got to wonder, what is it about this that from Epic's perspective, you know, makes them unique? What is that value that they think they bring? And I think then going from the developer relationship side to the consumer side, it really is, does Apple and that end-to-end system with the security and the peace of mind of having an approved app download system and certified, you know, virus-free distribution platform and seamless way to buy things, is that, and also being tightly integrated to iOS, is that the value proposition to consumer? Or does Epic think that they bring more to a platform like iOS because the kids love playing Fortnite and it's a killer app?
So, like, I am sensitive to the argument of how much Apple has invested to build this ecosystem. And it is a trusted ecosystem. I don't care about Epic. I could care, you know, to, you know, nothings about whether Epic is able to get 10%. The important thing is that Epic has enough money and seems mad enough to have marshaled the resources to actually engage in the fight, to see if there's nefarious practices that have gone on behind the scenes that are much more like what we'd consider a monopoly type behavior. If they're actively discouraging, if they're making other deals with other companies that bypass those 30%. And marshaling that law firm is important. So I think this is important for these small indie companies. And so that's what I'm interested in. I'm actually on Epic's side, but not because of why Epic is engaging in this fight. Epic is engaging in this fight because I do believe Fortnite is plateauing and they need to find ways to increase revenue on it. And so, you know, whatever. That's the life of being.
That's their motivation, right? How principled is this fight? Is this a fight about?
It's not principled. It's about money. But I think the potential benefits of this lawsuit, especially who they hired, which is a mega firm that deals in antitrust stuff, is significant. So I'm curious how that process goes. I'm not a legal scholar. I can't, you know, comment on that. But I think Apple still has the better hand. They're not a monopoly here. There is Google Play. There is the Amazon App Store, for whatever you want to call it, that Fortnite can then go to. And they don't have necessarily the sole market share.
Well, I'll also make that argument. One point is I will say that I also want to acknowledge the consoles, which is also the other parallel here, in which, you know, Epic has played well with Xbox and Sony, investors of their engine, and pay what we assume to be similar cuts to those manufacturers, those platforms, which are also closed systems, walled gardens. And so, again, that leads to how principled is this fight. Another point I want to make is that while they also have the billions to make the legal battle, they also have, which might be more important, the user base, the fervent, you know, the TikTok and the YouTubers that can play for their side. And maybe they think that's even more of a compelling part of their arsenal to make this fight.
Yeah, I concede. I would agree totally that Epic is doing this for money. Tim Sweeney even, you know, said as much on Twitter and said that there's nothing wrong with that, defending that, saying that, you know, that money is something that we work very hard for. And, you know, it's up to, this is an argument about how that those monies should be distributed, whether they should be, you know, paid to middlemen who did nothing except for a step, you know, keep an app store running. 30% of all quite a lot of money going to these middlemen versus staying with the consumers or going with Epic.
It's funny because that's going to be Apple's argument too. It's like, we put a lot of effort to build this thing,
but you know,
so we deserve to get paid for it. You know, like
when I first heard about this argument, I was actually on Apple's side. I was just like, well, this is the industry standard. Everybody does 30%, as you said, Norm, the consoles included. And I don't see Epic making a stink about that. They did bring a lawsuit against Google as well as Apple, but they're mainly focused on Apple. And I think that's because if you were to change Apple, everyone else would fall in line. Like that's the reason you focus on them.
And I don't think that we're going to get to a point where Apple, like there's no way, never say it's never, but I cannot see a future where Apple opens up their closed system as a result of this lawsuit. Even if they're forced to, you know, it is against their core of how they operate in terms of sideloading, right? And you can make the argument on Mac OS, on the Mac side, you know, you've been able to download, you know, the DMGs and open, you know, third-party applications. But I just don't see that on iOS.
There's too strong an argument about security and, you know, stability that they've always fallen back on. And it's a good argument. They're going to have a hard time. Yeah, I think you're right. Epic's going to have a hard time beating that door down. But I wouldn't be surprised if, I mean, Apple has, who knows? I mean, I think this is nothing to Apple, as you said, Kishore, but at the same time, I think that, you know, with Congress looking at them for antitrust, you know, right now already, and maybe, you know, this being more public backlash than they anticipated, it's possible they don't need this revenue. They really don't. But Apple does not know how to decrease profits. Like that's not in their DNA. They only know how to go up, and their shareholders would expect that of them. So it would be a difficult pill to swallow, but The thing that everybody has to acknowledge is that the revenue they're earning from the App Store is absurd. Like it really is like way beyond any kind of upkeep costs. And it is a major, major percentage of their services bottom line, which, you know, is what they report on every quarter.
Yeah. And it's absurd. It's absurd to talk about people worth billions of dollars and companies worth trillions of dollars as well. I mean, the scale of this operation is absurd because we can't comprehend it. And no company in the history of capitalism has ever been this big. I don't think that's the the fair argument for that this shouldn't happen this way because this is capitalism. But I think the point you're trying to make is that Apple cannot make the argument that Steve Jobs did 10 years ago that the App Store isn't an actual important part of their bottom line, isn't an important part of their services, which for them and the messaging they want to get across to their investors is the post-hardware world of Apple. You know, the rumors of them developing their bundle, Apple One service. Like, that's how they're going to grow their business and continue revenue growth is through services. And this kind of absolutely bolsters that.
They can't afford. That is the right approach. Like, making their take on app fees enough to cover their costs is the right approach. It's best for consumers. It is, because, you know, it allows developers to make the most profit, which makes them happy, and allows the consumers to pay as little as possible. So it makes their platform better. It just earns them less money. So yeah, it's maybe a longer tail effect, but I really do think that that's worth them considering.
Do you think they're stuck in a precedent that they established themselves?
Yeah.
That they can't get out of.
Yeah.
Who do you think will flinch first?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I don't think there's any flinching. I think this is going to court.
This is a real problem, though, in the near term for Epic. If they lose this license like in 2 weeks, that's a major encumberment to Epic's development of the Unreal Engine.
Right. And based on the terms, I know there was a question about whether Apple had the right to take away the license, developer license. And I think within the developer license agreement, if you pick that apart, you know, they were within the rights because Epic was clear in why they implemented their violation and their own in-payment app system. From a user perspective, are you just money aside, are you and okay with you and your kids, for example, working in multiple payment systems on a mobile device? I think that is different than on a desktop. Like, having a phone, you pay on most of your phone with whatever built-in, you know, buy your apps with a certain payment system, but once you're in the app, you got to, do your own registration form, your own login, your credit card again within the app. How comfortable are you with that? Is that encumbrance?
Isn't that the same thing that I'm experiencing with like 8 streaming services? Like, I know it's different in the sense that you're talking about unified payment, but it's not that different from an experience standpoint. Like, I feel like I'm bopping around from service to service right now. So I feel like that's no different.
Or browsing the web. You know, I've got a credit card numbers that auto-populate on most websites.
That's the PayPal argument, right? PayPal does the exact same thing, that you don't have to use Apple Pay for buying stuff on the web. Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the web experience as the analogy, people are fine with that. It is, in some places, less secure. And security at that scale, that's going to be Apple's argument. Yeah. All right. Anything more? Any final words? I think this is going to be an ongoing thing. We'll just keep on reporting on it.
This is going to take years. That's the thing I'll say. This is not some quick kick, quick fight that's going to be over next week.
We'll discuss this Facebook, you know, Oculus news later in the show. But it related to that. People have talked about, you know, Oculus takes 30%, and it's too much because the market is actually too small right now. So it's interesting just to think about like how much a company should be taking. It might actually start out small, get larger as it grows, and then once it's as big as Apple, it should come back down again. It's just an interesting
curve. It's the precedence, right? It is. And that curve, I don't think people think of, and especially the accountants don't think of it as a curve. Everyone wants to be a platform and wants that share to be like, you know, you're right. At certain scales, it doesn't make sense, especially when the people creating the platforms don't need that. It doesn't have any effect on the bottom line.
Yeah.
Like it even was for Apple 10 years ago. Anyway, we're going to talk about that topic next because we're going reverse order this week.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Here it goes.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality this week.
So, who wants to get ratioed? I think Facebook got ratioed. Oculus got ratioed yesterday with their announcement. This is the biggest news, certainly in our world, in the VR world.
What does that mean?
It means their announcement got certain number of likes and retweets, and the follow-up replies that were negative got way more likes and retweets.
Okay.
In this case, coming from HTC Vive and HP, who are you know, taking advantage of this situation. So, but let's talk about what the situation is exactly in case you haven't heard. Facebook Oculus made an announcement to that they are changing their terms of service, that for devices going forward, and this is a point of detail and clarification, starting in 2023, they're unifying their logins. So you must have, you must log into a Facebook account to use a Oculus device for future hardware. Does not affect the Rift and Quest. Yep.
I want to be clear on the date you said. 2023?
Three, I believe, is the
3 years from now.
That's when they made they. It's very. And this is the point that's worth discussing. A lot of it is because we are presumably a month out, like we said last week, from whenever they were going to host an Oculus Connect. We assume there will be an Oculus Connect this year in virtual form, and they were going to, you know, they saved their big announcements for that. So why make this announcement now? Is it to get ahead of that news? That is it to get through the news cycle? I'm sure they expected a lot of retaliatory feedback. I don't know if they expected it to this extent, because it has shocked, maybe not so much shocked, but it's definitely brought a lot of not just users but developers out of the woodwork talking about their experiences and how they feel about this. So
did you mention October of this year yet? In your recap, because that's part of the news, is that this year in October, any new hardware that's sold will require that. Like this year will require a Facebook account activation, whereas it's current hardware of like existing users like you and me, we won't have to merge our accounts until 2023.
So if you buy a Quest or a Rift in October,
right,
you have to use they're getting rid of that Oculus login system, but keeping it for legacy users. So get your hardware now, I guess. Yeah. If you especially your Rift and your Quest is not your Go's, you can't buy those anymore. Let's talk about why there's such a strong reaction to this, and from the user perspective. And we're going to again talk about users and developers. From the user perspective, one, there's just negative Facebook sentiment, right? Like the practices that they've seen in terms of the culture that some of those communities cultivate, and tying to those accounts, people don't like. I don't think this would be as big of an issue if people like Facebook as a company, as a service more. And if you think about services that they also own, like Instagram, it's not a requirement. Instagram is many times, many orders of magnitude bigger than Oculus right now. So, obviously, Facebook making a big investment in Oculus and seeing it VR and mixed reality as a major platform in the future, this seems to be them doubling down on that and making sure that, you know, in the terms of service, they can sell you ads based on your Facebook profile, based on the types of things you do in VR. And this seems to be where so much of that concern is. There's also the promise keeping. So when Oculus first sold to Facebook, I guess he wasn't CEO, but co-founder Palmer Luckey had said that they would never require that you have a Facebook account to use an Oculus device. And he came out yesterday to say, no, he was wrong. He was mistaken.
I missed that.
That people who had concerns about that were probably more in touch with the reality of it than he was. And some people are, gave him grief over that as a founder. And this is something that, small companies who get taken over by big companies see all the time. This should have not been a surprise, even for people in the company. But maybe they were, they were enamored with that acquisition and that partnership.
I just want to reiterate how much vitriol there was over this. I was really quite surprised. I went to the Oculus subreddit, which you think is going to be like the place you'll find the fanboys. And like the thread that covered this topic was literally every comment was negative. There was one at the bottom that said, I don't care, I've already merged my accounts. And I had to uncurl that account because it had been downvoted six times.
Yeah.
And so
I think it goes to all the things we talked about in terms of the promise that was made on the Oculus side.
Yeah.
The distaste for a lot of the practices and communities and services of Facebook right now. The fear that people have of how that their data will be used for ad purposes. And also the position of strength that Facebook has right now and Oculus has right now in the VR, you know, community. This is not an Apple, Google, you know, iOS, Android world where there is, at least on the mobile VR side, an alternative. And, you know, you have to credit that the strength of Quest right now to the money that Facebook put into that platform, right? So much of VR exists right now in the Oculus world because of all that money. And I think this isn't I'm not shocked by this.
They're doing this?
Oculus is doing this.
I'm shocked it took so long.
I think I'm happy that people are complaining. And I think if they want this to not happen, then they should complain more and they should stop buying those products and move the needle. I don't know if that's going to actually happen, but I think that it's worth voicing that opinion. And I'm sure the people within Facebook and Oculus are aware of it. Those people may not be the ones making the decision ultimately.
Exactly. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
These voices should be heard and developers, I think more important, developers are coming out and talking about their experiences. And it's worth reading, like from Darshan, he had a Twitter thread about, you know, how this handicaps him, how something, the policies like the 30% cut handicaps his business because of the kind of relationships he has had with the studios and distributing films.
He's the CEO of Big Screen.
Big Screen, exactly.
This feels like an old fight too, on some way. Like, this is a fight that every time I buy a piece of hardware, what do I actually own about it, and being tied to how I use it. Like, I don't know. I just had installed a Windows update the other day and it's like, here comes Microsoft Edge back on your computer. And like, you know, like there's always been that tension regardless of hardware. So in a way that I'm with Jeremy, I'm surprised this didn't come sooner. But this isn't a surprising announcement in a lot of ways.
The thing, like, Quest is far and away the best, you know, standalone $6 headset you can buy. Like, everybody knows that. And so it's been a game changer for the VR industry. And if Oculus maintains their lead with the next generation of this technology, of course I'm going to buy it. And I have a hard time believing the VR faith, like the VR hardcore, the true believers, aren't going to buy it too, even if they have to sign up with their Facebook account. And where I come from with that is like, I'm afraid to share my opinion because of all the vitriol on that's surrounding this topic. But honestly, people, make a separate Facebook account. Just make a new account.
Make a burner account, right?
What's the difference between doing that and signing up with some new, you know, company and signing up with their service? Just make.
I'm going to tell you the difference.
Tell me.
One is that is actually against the terms of service, and I know it's not enforced. But
how could that possibly? How can they enforce that?
I don't know how they could, but it technically, if you create the account, that's not a representation of you, because one of the arguments they're making is that this ties into, you know, their social media plan, that they want people to be tied to their real ID, and there are legitimate concerns about doxing and about identity in VR, because one of the promises of VR is to be who you want to be and not necessarily have it track to, you know, who you are.
But I'm not going to say
there are pros and cons.
I'm not going to say I'm Norman Chan. I'm going to say I'm me. It's just going to be a second
count. That's you though, right? So
what
I'm saying that their terms of service say that if people create accounts and then they have the right, if they create accounts just for the sake of getting bypassing, mm-hmm. right? This, then they might lose those accounts in the future and the purchases they make. It's a risk you take, right? And maybe it's the risk that you're okay with. I think another completely valid objection to that are people who, for education purposes, who bought multiple headsets, or developers who need multiple headsets and don't have multiple Facebook accounts to run, you know, dozens of headsets that they need for development or for education.
Or for enterprise. Same
or
problem.
Or enterprise.
I'm sure they'll solve that problem.
Well, their solution for it is $400 a year per headset as an enterprise fee, which a lot of small time developers and people in education can't afford. And, you know, and you can make the argument again about whether that's the right thing to charge and that they have a right to charge an enterprise fee for enterprise services. But I think that stifles growth and innovation in VR and the versatility and the openness of VR also.
Well, back to my suggestion that you open a new account. I'm sort of in that position already, except I only have one account. And the trick is, don't use Facebook for anything else. Like, I'm not on there. Like, I haven't posted to my Facebook wall in 5 years. And it's just something I sign into things with. I'm a member of a couple groups, private groups, but I don't use Facebook. I mean, there's no difference between not buying, you know, not using Facebook and just using it in order to sign into your VR headset. I don't see the conflict there.
I think there's also a fundamental problem and a dissociation people have with VR as hardware and what the business model is. Because when we look at VR devices, it is, you know, on the surface, we want to think of them as similar to other electronics that we buy, computing devices, tablets, phones, PCs, game consoles, where the business models are you pay for the hardware, you pay for the software, that's the transaction. And, you know, at least from Apple's perspective, you know, they make their business not about personal information and just about the transaction of buying applications and buying hardware. Whereas the fear here is the Facebook model isn't even like the console model where they're making a loss in hardware and making it back in software. Their fear is that it's about owning information about you, even anonymously, that you don't want to give out because you're giving it out subconsciously, eye tracking, body movements, head movements, thing that we're just as society unprepared for psychologically. You know, it's the Ready Player One. It's Nolan Sorrento making his board meeting and saying we can cover X. And I don't think it's going to get to that point. Like the user experience, there's still a user experience, you know, to service and to develop for, but it's about the things that most people who aren't tuned to this podcast, who maybe just want to play Beat Saber or want to play something cool in VR that they don't know. You know, it's very reminiscent. It is an old fight. It's very reminiscent to the days of cookie tracking, you know, on web browsers. And maybe we can look to that model to see how this will end up. Because that's still happening today, you know, the web tracking, and to a large extent, it's been accepted as a part of that web browsing experience. But then you also have legislation that requires the opt-in for that on websites.
Yeah, that happened a couple months ago. Everywhere you go now, you have to opt into the cookies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So maybe legislation that gets people more accepting of this at the end of it all. But all these factors of the promise keeping of what Oculus said when they were first acquired, to the strength of Facebook right now, right, being kind of the only option in mobile VR space, to the awareness that enthusiasts have about the future of VR and what can be tracked, and then the fundamental business model differences between this as a piece of hardware versus other electronics we buy, all of that, and also then on top of that, just the general distaste of the type of cultures that we see on Facebook, all of that have compounded to make this vitriol reaction. I think that's a fair assessment of the situation, right?
I do too. And we only have a half hour for the rest of the show.
Oh my goodness, you are absolutely right. Let's talk about some games and content. This is a game that's not coming out on Quest, so you can look forward to that on Steam and other platforms. It's from Servios. It's a Walking Dead game. Remember, there are two Walking Dead VR games coming out. This is Walking Dead Onslaught, and they now have a release date. It's available for pre-order September. End of September is when it's coming out. I believe September 28th. Is that right? Yeah. But this is from Skydance. Or sorry, not the one from Skydance. It's from Servios. September 29th. And this one has licenses of the TV show.
Oh, I got a demo of this at like a couple of years ago at GDC.
Oh, did you?
They didn't even want us to know it was Walking Dead. Like the logo popped up there, and they're like, "Just ignore that. Ignore that." But the tech in this is gruesome. Like, they have serious, like, levels of gore where you can, like, remove skin from bone. It's nuts. Cool. Yeah.
All right. Cool. I'm looking forward to playing that. Return of Castle Wolfenstein is something you can now sideload on Quest. I haven't played it yet. Have you, Jeremy?
No, because I'm not in the beta. It's out tomorrow, i.e. today, if you're listening to the podcast. Can't wait to play it. It was on sale on Steam, or maybe even free or something like that this week. So super cheap on Steam. You're going to need the full game to play it, but it's going to be sideloadable, just like Quake and Half-Life were. Fantastic. I love this guy's mods. Fantastic.
Yeah, I really hope that one thing that this is going back to the last story, we can still sideload things right now and play things on desktop VR and on mobile VR. And that's one of those things that we absolutely need to protect as well. Because a place like SideQuest is great for developers. You know, the user base, it's only in the thousands. It's not the hundreds of thousands. But as a place to quickly release and get basically early access to content, I think it's really important to VR experimentation.
SideQuest?
SideQuest.
Yeah, absolutely. They had a big update today, actually, a full reskin of their app.
Yeah. All right, let's quickly move on then, because we got to get to the segment we didn't have last week. And that is, oh my gosh, where's my music? I was so caught up in this.
I have one.
Oh, you have one more thing? Oh, hold on. Let me turn. Okay, yep, you have one more thing. Go ahead.
Tactical Haptics.
Sorry about that.
Not in the show list here, but yes. We have a bit of a heads up that later today, if you're listening to this on Thursday, they will be announcing some updates. These are the guys that we put on projections almost a year ago
At Augmented World Expo.
AWE. Yeah, where they had the haptics that did the shearing effect, where they had these two things that would go up and down on your hand, and it had a really novel approach to haptics. I think I called it like my favorite approach that I'd experienced up until then. Well, they have been working, you know, since last year around the clock, and they have some new designs that they've announced. One is this, with looks like it's a simplified version of what they had, which is more like a lightsaber kind of design, where you can attach either Oculus to the top or a Vive Puck. But it uses the same shearing effect as their classic design.
So those two grip pads you see on the left and right, those pads where you hold and you feel your palm, we have a lot of nerve endings as well as the fingertips. We have so many nerve endings. Those pads move up and down and they kind of rub against your skin to create the simulation of weight and resistance.
Yeah, it's surprisingly effective, and it can do what I think is most interesting is, like, unlike traditional haptics where it rumbles or shakes momentarily or repeatedly, this can create constant force. So those can move in one direction and stay there, which gives the feeling of like constant weight or, you know, something like that. It's really, really cool. They call this the Saber Grip. They had already been selling it to location-based LBEs before COVID, and then they had to put things on pause. But that hopefully is going to be a new commercial product that they'll be shipping. But then they also have this other thing that they've been working on, which is they noticed when we interviewed them in the comments that people were super interested in this approach. You know, besides the haptics, they had this cool magnetic approach to their containers, where they would connect to each other in different ways to create different interfaces. And they basically made that just for Quest or touch controllers, I suppose, would work on the Rift.
So this is a passive system where you don't need to have any custom programming. It literally is a way, as opposed to attaching a PVC pipe and making grips for your Quest to simulate holding a sword or handlebars or a two-handed rifle. You can just mount these in and these strong magnets attach them. That's great.
This is the kind of thing that I think appeals most to consumers. I mean, the other stuff is really location-based focused, but this is the kind of thing this would work. You know, a game could implement support for this without needing to access any kind of hardware, since it's a passive device. You just need to add support for that position, and you could reliably detect when it's in that position or changes to a different one and alter your game, you know.
That's fascinating, right? Because you can absolutely, because you have sixed off tracking, all you do is get the pose locked in and sense that it's kind of not shifting from that pose. And so you can assume that they're locked in, and then it would enable some type of mode in software. That's great. I love that idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so wish them luck. Check out Tactical Haptics, I think, .com. And there's a few other announcements that they made today as well.
Awesome. very cool. I want to try their Saber Grip. Yes, get us a Saber Grip. We'll do an episode about it. Please, Tactical Haptics. Okay, now let's move on to our next segment. Here we go.
Now it's time for a moment of science. So just a quick story this week, and I'm going to talk about testing, but maybe not the way you expect. So if you think about how somebody gets infected and the viral load. So if you say day zero, I just get the virus, you start with very little virus in your system. And then it slowly replicates in your body and it builds up over time. And these are sort of gross numbers, but just sort of take it as a generalization. If you're somebody that actually becomes symptomatic, it usually takes around like 5 days for you to, from when you get the virus to when you develop symptoms. During that course, during the first few days, you go from basically like no virus to maybe around like 100 to a virus concentration around like, you know, 10 to the 1, maybe 10 to the 2 by like day 3, day 4. At those levels, like at a viral concentration of 100 to 1,000, the PCR tests that we use right now can pick it up because they're high sensitivity. They're meant to do that. But you really don't become contagious, quote unquote, until the viral load gets to like 1,000. So you have like another day or two. And then we think between days like 5 and 10 is when you're most transmissible, when the viral load increases like significantly. So one question that's been raised by a number of researchers, I think Michael Minna from the Harvard School of Public Health has been one of the chief people popularizing this, is, are we testing the wrong way? Like, we're testing with these super high sensitivity tests to pick up when anyone has any virus. But what if we just tried to find the people that were able to transmit virus? Like those people that had gotten to like 1,000 or 10,000 viral. And there's a cheaper way to do that because there's a low sensitivity test that you could just take at home that doesn't require any chemicals, that just uses your saliva. And those tests have been in existence. And the FDA this week approved a protocol called Saliva Direct. I think it was on Monday. It might have been Monday or Tuesday. It was just a few days ago that they approved this. This is a protocol developed out of Yale. And the protocol allows you to take a saliva sample and get results within 3 to 5 hours of the test. Now, it has lower sensitivity than the current tests, but the materials cost for it is about $4 a test. The current cost for a high sensitivity test in just materials is about $100. And what this will do, if we can scale something like this, is you can get results in a matter of hours. It's a lot cheaper by a factor of 20, and it allows us to rapidly do multiple tests around the same people over a short period of time. So let's say you're a college campus. You have 20,000 kids on your campus. You need to not just be able to do one test. You have to do multiple tests on them in a week. How are you going to pay 20,000 times 100 times the number of times you want to do that test? Where if it's 20,000 times like $5, you can do a couple tests a week very quickly, find the people that are most that are transmitting the virus and quarantine them. So this idea behind Saliva Direct can be revolutionary if we scale this in really quickly and allow us to continue to scale testing, which is largely plateaued in this country in a way that we haven't seen before, just because of the cost, but more importantly, the turnaround time. And you know what is really interesting about this story? Any guesses who funded the work that went into make Saliva Direct happen?
What type of industry?
You won't guess. I'll tell you that. It's the NBA.
Interesting. Because of the bubble?
They needed to develop a quick, effective test that was low turnaround and also not take away capacity from testing in Florida, where there was a significant outbreak. And so they had funded research and in part supported this work. And it so it's a massive win all around if we're able to put this into practice. But I just want to emphasize that when it comes to testing, you can either have high sensitivity, speed, and low cost, but you can, of those three, you can probably have two. You probably can't have all three. So this is an opportunity for us to think about what does it look like to do something that's low cost with speed, instead of necessarily having the most accurate diagnosis, as a way of like curtailing this virus. This could really be revolutionary if we're able to implement it.
Do you think there's a test that could be applied to other coronaviruses?
I mean, the other coronaviruses that exist are like common colds, and so we like they don't put people in the hospital. So,
no, but I'm wondering if going forward, you know, assuming we'll have another pandemic, is this something that we can take as a learning experience?
Very much so. Very much cool. So. But I think the idea here is we only have to do this now because of the position we're in, because there's so much virus in this country. The idea is you don't get to this point if you make decisive, early, quick action. And then we're not talking about this. Like South Korea never had to get into the situation about arguing about testing because of protocols they put in place early. That's a much better place to be in overall. So I think this would be down the list, but yes, it can totally be applied forward to the next pandemic, but you would hope we'd never get into this situation.
From a communication standpoint, do you think that there would need to be delineation, or currently needs to be delineation in terms of testing? Because that kind of all gets bundled into one statistic, which is easy to process, but can be misinterpreted in many ways, especially when you have something like this where you're looking for different things. And
it's already happening right now. So put aside the saliva test, which really isn't, you know, highly in the marketplace right now. There's a few places that are doing it, like the University of Illinois, I believe, is doing this with college students. But when you look at state testing data, a lot of what you see is a combination of multiple testing types. So you'll see antibody tests mixed in there with the PCR tests. So we're already there, Norm. So I think noisy environment, adding more noise, maybe not necessarily changing anything.
Got it. Delineation is good. All right. Clarification, context. Always go for more context. Thanks for the science update this week. We're going to move right along for a short technology segment. We could cover a lot of tech in our top stories in VR already. So we're going to go through a speed round of tech. First of all, Amazon court in, where did this court, appeals court, California, held that Amazon can be held liable for damages and injuries sold by caused by faulty products sold by third-party marketplace. And this was a reversal of a Superior Court decision that Amazon couldn't be responsible. And this, I think, is a good thing because hopefully it gets Amazon to act together in terms of regulating some of those third-party products. Right now, it's kind of Wild West in terms of the quality of the things you buy, not directly from them.
I think this is a big deal because it also means if Amazon's forced to deal with this, they probably are going to have to be more active about pulling counterfeit merchandise from their marketplace. So that's going to reduce the amount of stuff available on Amazon, creating like a potentially like a slightly more limited funnel, might lead to some increases in prices too on certain products too. I think this was really interesting to follow. I'm glad it's happening, but I think there'll be some downstream effects of them putting this into practice.
Just to be clear, this isn't somebody who bought a battery and thought it was an Energizer and it was a, you know, didn't have the name brand on it. This is a woman who bought a laptop battery, put it in her laptop, and it caught on fire. Yeah. And I gave her third-degree burns. And so, yeah, I'm with Kishore. I think, you know, whether or not you think it's a fair thing for Amazon, this is a good thing for consumers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. More accountability in their system. Not so close. It's kind of the opposite. Anyone can sell anything right now as long as they give that cut and that data to Amazon. All right. We mentioned this earlier. The rumor is that Apple is going to start doing a subscription service. Now, this isn't the one that we predicted years ago in terms of the hardware subscription service, which I still think isn't to come. I think, but that's probably more of an accounting issue than anything, because right now you have that iPhone, you know, monthly payment plan, but they have to create this whole bank system of, so Apple gets the, all that money up front, and then you're paying this bank on a zero interest base system, this monthly fee. But I do think we're going to get there. We're going to do a bundle. We're going to get a watch, a phone, and maybe something else for, I think, you know, they want to get your $100 a month. But outside of that, services, 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 the rumor is that it's going to be called Apple One, anchored by Apple Music and Apple TV Plus. I'll give you one guess as to which you think is the stronger of these services. and then they were going to tier that up with Arcade, News, and on top of that, the rumor is iCloud service. Now, if you look at this, it's very much indicative to me of which services they think are strongest to them. Because, you know, if you design a tiered system, you got to put in, like if you look again, look at the Amazon model, you put in the essential service first, or the one that people value the most first. In this case, on Apple, it's Apple Music. It's one that people are paying for, used to paying for. Apple TV Plus, I think they're still struggling on making that the value proposition worth it. And so bundled that makes total sense. Apple News and Arcade, I think those are still iffy propositions right now, especially Arcade. Strong launch, kind of petered off. Not a lot of news about the games and stuff that have been part of that. But I think those are also ones that they can't just group in, because there are a lot of partners that they need to pay their, rightly so, their cut to. And so those need to be add-on. Putting iCloud at the top, that is a brilliant move on their end, because that is another one of those essential services where people may not know they need it, but you know, once you're on board on iCloud, it changes the way you use the hardware you've already spent $1,000 on, because it really is an essential service in today's world going forward, especially for people who've adopted Apple devices for a long time. You need those big family plans of online storage.
Apple loves them too, because it locks you in there. Once you have so much data up there that you're over the limit, you can't downgrade or you lose your data.
It's a problem that's going to grow over time in favor of Apple, and at the literal cost of users. You know, 10 years now that we're 13 years of owning iPhones, your photos that you had on your first iPhones, they're either stuck on those phones most of the time. Very few people have, you know, sync those even on the Mac side. So their Photos app or on their PC, sync those using iCloud for Windows, you know, downloaded those on the PC. They're basically, I think, for a large number of people, locked in their phones, or you're paying Apple to store them on iCloud. And as the camera sensors got bigger and as the resolution got bigger on those phones, as you can shoot 4K video, it's just going to be more and more. I mean, I have a 256 gig phone and it's out of storage just for videos. And, you know, I don't want to have to micromanage that. And I don't want those photos and those videos to go away. And so I'm kind of, you know, held hostage by Apple and holding those on iCloud. Yeah, I hear you out there. I could spend half a day's time and sync everything to my PC, but that's not how most people operate. And when you're moving from phone to phone, you know, year to year, or every other year, every third year, you want to have that media on your new phones as well. It's just the way it is.
Well, yeah, you also had a baby in the age of 4K video, so deal with it.
I had the baby in the age of 5K stereo video, Jeremy. I have gigabytes and gigabytes of stereo video. Then that stuff eats up hard drives and store solid state drives like nothing. Anyway, that's a different type of problem. Okay, Netflix announced that they are introducing a shuffle button. Now, I have an idea in my head of how I want this to work, but how is this going to work?
Well, they're only testing it. They're only it's not something that's going to go live unless people dig it. But a few people have discovered that they log in instead of, well, along with all the users that you can choose from in your accounts, there's a button that just says, surprise me, you know, shuffle, and it will play a random show. By all accounts so far, it seems to only be playing Netflix shows, but it will play you a random episode of a random TV show. And it's just, you know, it's a shuffle button. See what you get. Maybe you're up for a spin in that wheel.
No. Hey guys, presumably. Remember when we all used to hit the I'm feeling lucky button on Google? No. Remember that? Remember how we used to use that feature and continue to use that feature all the time?
That is different. That is different because that was like the top result. That was the top result. This is truly like chat roulette. this is more like, you know.
Oh, so you're saying this is worse. Cool.
Yes.
Presumably, if they introduce you to a new show, it's not like you're going to watch one episode of The Crown. It's not going to jump you in the middle of The Crown, right? It's not going to be like, here's a random fourth season episode of Orange is the New Black or House of Cards. They're going to throw you into the pilot and then get you to binge, right? It's just like, this is just an entry point into one of their series.
I would hope so, but the article I read said a random episode.
That doesn't seem like the right way to do it.
Right.
Although that, I would say that is the TV experience, though. That is channel flipping.
Yes.
I mean, at that point, don't throw me at the beginning episode. Throw me into like 20 minutes in. Like, sync me the time of day, right? I'm like, it's you know, it's 12:50 right now. I want to catch the last 10 minutes. I mean, that I have some of my best, like, I need to burn 15 minutes before my next phone call and I need to scarf down lunch. Give me the last 15 minutes of a Law and Order because that's what I want to see at this moment. And then I can kind of reverse. That's a fun intellectual exercise of deducing what happened beforehand. And maybe it might get me to reverse that, you know, rewatch that thing later. Same with movies. Get me to a interesting climax. They have the viewer data. They know the curves about the heat maps of which part of episodes and movies people like watching the most. Really, right? Like, throw me into knowing that, you know, I have 20 minutes or something. Throw me into the best part of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Hey, you know what? Here you describe it. I'm into it. Like, discoverability on Netflix is as bad as it is on iOS. Like, there's so much content there and you can't possibly explore it. You might as well shuffle it and just give me something at random.
Yeah. And then the way I would really want this to work is not just with Netflix exclusive shows, but the library of shows. I know they don't have The Simpsons, but, you know, if someone's going to watch West Wing, I want the button that gives me the random episode just within the parameters of this series. Star Trek. Give me a random Star Trek episode, right? Or TNG episode. That's what I want. That's also another part of the channel surfing experience.
I got an idea. Why don't they do a bunch of, like, they could even create 100 stations and you could join them and they're live synced with everyone else in the world who's watching that station. And you can go to the chat room for that station and chat with people.
Turntable.fm.
Star Trek 24 hours a day.
Turntable.fm. Apple Music One, right? The shared communal experience.
Exactly.
You know, if you don't, I mean, there are third party syncing things. But yeah, some type of one to many. I mean, Amazon's smartly doing that with Twitch and letting people broadcast Twitch and do commentaries themselves about Amazon Prime content. And if people have Amazon Prime, then they can easily click in and get whatever that piece of content is synced live to their audience. And so it may not be, you know, one to a million or tens of millions, but for thousands of users who follow those streamers to do that, that is that. And it's exactly what Turntable FM was doing 10 years ago now for music. That was super fun. And we want that. Spotify didn't really capitalize on it. You know, and for video, I'd love to see Netflix experiment. All right. What's next? Untitled Goose Game? Geese Game?
Geese Game. We're getting multiplayer. An Untitled Goose Game. One of my favorite games of last year. Now you can play multiplayer. Awesome. Sign me up.
All right. There
what
you go.
Did you play
That's
on?
The news.
Switch?
I played on Switch.
Yep. I haven't played it yet. I need to.
Free update?
It's incredible.
Speaking of... Oh, good.
Yeah, it is free, right?
Yep. Free September 23rd. Speaking of another free update, also multiplayer, this was a big surprise, Ghost of Tsushima, which I've been enjoying on PS4, is getting two-player and four-player co-op multiplayer, as well as a raid mode.
Not for the whole game.
Not for the whole game. So it's going to be select, because the game is scripted single-player, but much like Red Dead Redemption, launch multiplayer with Red Dead Online, and people can band together and go on these missions. This will be like that. Two players can go on these, explore the world and do find these small stories. So they have these little vignette stories that pop up throughout the world, the mythology that you unearth, and they'll allow that. And then with four players, they're going to allow these type of big boss battles and four player raids. So no whole new realms with terrifying enemies and challenges. So it's going to keep the legs on that going, which congrats to them. It's a gorgeous game. You know, Sucker Punch deserves all the accolades for making a wonderful PS4 game. Panic, we have an update on the play date.
Oh, yeah, cool. What's that? When is it coming out?
So, not that kind of update, but they did show some of teasers of games, of their third-party titles. That, and I'm of two minds about this, because I want the games to be a surprise. Like, the whole idea is this: you buy this dedicated console, you pay this fee, and you get a season of games that unlock on regular intervals. And the idea is the water cooler moment of this month, this new small handheld game unlocks, and everyone with a playdate plays together and chats about it on Discord or streams or wherever. And it compels people to play these small games with novel controls.
This is the Game Boy style portable console with a crank on the
with
side.
The crank. And so the genres, I think I'm okay reading about, you know, puzzlers, dungeon crawlers, you know, games like Tetris, things with tilt controls. But I don't actually want to see the games yet. They are sharing it on their Twitter account. If you want to follow at, is it at Playdate, then they will, they're showing some short videos. It's all grayscale, of course. They will have an update. They said in the next few months that talk about their production timeline and the pre-order process.
The cool thing that that caught fire in my Twitter stream was Doom, which of course it runs Doom, yep. But what it does that no other Doom does is the crank controls the Gatling gun, which is
the
perfect.
Vulcan. Yeah, that's awesome. All right, very good to know. That does it, I think, for tech news this week. Oh, we are running very low on time, so we're going to run through pop culture. And do I have it queued up? I don't. Oh my god, all sorts of, here we go. Pop culture.
Pop culture, news culture.
We got the DC Fan Dome event coming in just a few days, August 22nd. This is their virtual event, which is like, it's like a Coachella style lineup of guests and people presenting all sorts of stuff from the DC universe, not just the movies, but TV shows and everything. It's so big that DC announced that they're going to be splitting into two events now, one in August and one in September. Their big tentpole stuff, if you want to hear about Batman, the Batman from Matt Reeves, that's still going to be in the August event. And then the expanded universe stuff in DC will be in September, and maybe some more surprises there. Of course, it's also where Zack Snyder is going to be showing maybe a trailer for his version of Justice League. And so I know a lot of people online are looking forward to that. You have to sign up. It's a free event, live stream.
I'm not sure this blunts like the huge layoffs that happened at DC last week, but I kind of understand what they're trying to do.
Yeah, it's really tough. Yeah, as you know, Jim Lee's still there, and he was saying they're still in the business of comics, but acknowledge that, you know, the comics that weren't making money are going away. We didn't talk about this extensively last week, but you know, the idea that comics is not, they don't think of it as a big business for them, but even to not have it as a source of IP, like, people love the characters, not just because they love Batman and Superman, but because the stories have been ongoing, developing, right? You have these teases of even things in the video games, like, you know, a Court of Owls game from Rocksteady, right, coming out. Like, we would not have that storyline if 10 years ago that wasn't a part of the comic story. That's a relatively recent thing. All these fan favorite creations, like an Arkham Knight, right, the Red Hood, like, all that stuff are modern takes, right? We don't think of these characters as staying stagnant, and they can't just grow and develop on the big screen or even the small screen. Comics are where artists and writers have the flexibility to tell those stories, and it's a real tragedy that is a part of business that, because it doesn't make the money, and I get that they're cutting.
Yeah, I'll just say that they spent a ton of money to build out a streaming service that they're folding now. And so that's why they ran out of money for comics and other things.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, all right. Last bit, confirmation. Ready Player 2 audiobook will be read by Will Wheaton.
His reading of Ready Player 1 is his best work. And so I suspect this will be good. I'm excited.
And on Disney Plus, they're doing a Lego Star Wars holiday special animation.
What?
Yeah.
Of all the Star Wars things to recreate, why the holiday special?
They're not recreating the holiday special. They're just building it. They want this to be the canonical holiday special going forward and using the animation of Lego Star Wars to do it.
Got it.
Irreverent take. I think there will be some like obvious references to the 1978 special, and maybe this is their way of soft acknowledging that without making it canon. It is its own thing.
Oh, it'll stream on Disney Plus November 17th.
Yep. And we're just 2 weeks away from Mulan. You guys got your friends queued up? Your $30?
My Disney friends.
Plus, plus? Your family?
I mean,
you guys are going to rent it, right? 30 bucks?
Yeah, I'm going to rent it.
Yeah.
I don't know about
queuing. I'm going to rent it. My friends. I don't need other people to watch with me. I'll get my son in the room. That's enough. $15 each.
Yeah. You make sure you charge that fee. Make sure it's all accounted for. All right, that does it for the podcast this week. We made it. We made it to our deadline because actually I have to get on the road for another trip, videos of which you'll see later this week and early next week. But thank you guys for joining me this week. Thank you all out there for listening. If you have an intro song that you want to create and share with us, we will play it in the future. Just send us the SoundCloud link either over email. You can email me, norman@tested, or can ping us on Twitter and we'll save those. We have over a dozen still to play.
I have a quick plug. Friend of Tested, David Peterson of Mouse Guard, is doing a Mouse Guard online con, and I'm actually talking about the science of Mouse Guard on Thursday night. And Gary is talking about like the work they had done together on building a Mouse Guard movie together on Saturday. And there's lots of great artists and other people involved in that online con. It's all on David Peterson's Twitch channel.
Gary piloted a new Twitch concept called the Sid Sounds of the 80s. It's a whole new talk show where he just talks over Commodore 64 music. It's on his Twitch archive, and I highly recommend it. It's fantastic.
Is it really fantastic, or is it?
That doesn't sound really fantastic.
I loved it. No. If you know, if I said Sid music, Commodore 64, and your ears perked up, you're who I'm talking to. And you should go listen to this. Because first, he does this whole 1 hour intro with no music where he just talks about his history and video games and the computers he owned. It's nerdy as hell. But the music he chooses is freaking good. So tune in. I recommend it. I really enjoyed it. I hope he does more of those.
All right. And you gave a great recommendation to us. Captain Disillusion, a YouTube channel, has been killing it with some primers on video and imaging. The latest
one. The one on color this week. Oh, incredible.
Yeah. You know, those CD episodes were supposed to be these shorter one-offs that he could just, you know, pump out. And like the amount of compositing in motion graphics he's putting into these things is off the chart.
It's incredible. Incredible. Well worth subscribing to and watching. Thanks for sharing that, Jeremy. And we do have to share an outro this week. This one also comes from Black Powder Engine. Thank you for making it. These are awesome. I haven't listened to this one yet either, but let's enjoy it together.
Hi there. I didn't see you.
Tested.
Movies are still being made, including Tron the Third. The question is, will they continue the storyline?
Who cares? Nobody cares. Okay, look, I shouldn't say that because clearly people care. You care about Lower Decks. So,
wow. That's the most amount of shade that Jeremy has dropped ever on this podcast. Go watch Lower Decks.
How's episode 2?
It's fantastic. All right. See you guys next time. Bye.